morning today. I know that some of you will have heard me before the last couple of days, and some of you won't. So my name is Kendra, and I come from Fort Worth, Texas. I am not from Fort Worth, Texas, but you're from Fort Worth, Texas. You're from Fort Worth, Texas. I'm from Iowa, but by way of PhD program and serving churches, ended up in Fort Worth, Texas. And so I'm here this week talking about masculinity and the New Testament, and we're focusing in on Matthew, because I find it easier sometimes. You either sort of do all of the Gospels, or you just sort of focus in on the one, so you have one train of thought going through your head. So we're talking about masculinity. Yesterday we talked about John the Baptist and characteristics of masculinity, and how they compare, contrast, mimic, resist Roman Empire and the Empire's understanding of masculinity. And then now today we're going to talk about Peter. So if you haven't been to the other ones, just to give you the lenses, there are a lot of ways to think about ancient masculinity, Roman masculinity. There are certain characteristics that we see that's very much a competition for status, that's a behavior that one practices and that you earn a masculine status in society, that there's a sliding scale, so you can be in competition with somebody else and you can gain or lose ground in an interaction. It's a public display, so public speeches or arguments are involved in sort of establishing one's masculinity. And then I've isolated these three lenses just for the sake of doing a dissertation, right? You have a project in order to do. And we were just talking, I could have basically done an entire dissertation on the role of emotion in masculinity and then how that relates. So you could pick any number one of these, but these are the three that I thought worked pretty well for Matthew's gospel. So we have wealth, dominating control over self and over others, and divine service. So again, wealth here is a demonstration of, you know, sort of lavish wealth, of being able to show that you have a lot of resources. It's connected to power in that, you know, the emperors would put their own pictures on coins. So as you walked around, you carried pictures of them, and those pictures were stylized to make them look as masculine as possible. So the masculinity piece and the wealth piece are intertwined. There's also the sense of wealth. Having wealth gives you a sense of righteousness and of being connected to the divine. Because if you have the resources, then you have been able to access the divine, or God is smiling on you, however you want to make that chicken and egg sort of argument. The dominating control over self and others, that has to do a lot with bodies. So your ability to protect your own body from attack or penetration, and that could be military, it could be sexual, however, your body being able to be preserved is a sign of masculinity. And then your ability to use other people's bodies for your ends. Again, that could be military, could be sexual. Your ability to basically have other people bear your death in their body. So having a slave who works extra hard so that you live longer, that's a sign of masculinity, because you're not vulnerable. Someone else is taking that on for you. Of course, that's not just among men, it's also control over women. That's a really important part. We're not doing Joseph this week, but that's a big part of the part that I talked about in the chapter about Joseph, was his ability to control the body of Mary. And you know, her life and death basically rests in his hands. So that sort of dynamic is a part of that as well. And then the third, divine service. And this could be prophetic speech, like we heard from John the Baptist, where he basically says, I speak for God. Yeah. It also could be this kind of rhetoric where you say, like, my lifestyle is affiliated with God, or I'm a part of what God is doing, and all of those things enhance masculine stature. And so that's very short. But those are our three lenses. Today we're going to talk about Peter. I think there is an underlying tension in Peter's character, especially in Matthew, that you can try this on up for size today as we think about this, but I think there's an underlying tension in Peter's masculinity and Peter's leadership that is part of the tension that we feel in the church all the time. And so I think this is a very important figure to study, and his masculinity is very significant. We talked yesterday about John the Baptist sort of being this alternative outsider. Peter's not an outsider. Peter is the institution. He becomes the institution. So the inherent tension in Peter is the inherent tension in the institution. Okay, so this is a picture of the statue of Peter outside of St. Peter's in Rome. Yeah, when you come in, if you've been to St. Peter's, you stand in the line to go through security. And then you go in on the right, and there's actually a statue of Paul. And I was like, what's he doing here? And then when you come out the other side, then Peter stands there. And those of you that know my husband, he's a bishop, and he... you know, he takes his job very seriously, but not like the title. So we had to be sure to take a selfie with Peter in the picture as we walked out. All right, so Peter's primacy, and what do I mean by that? In Matthew 10, this is after the call story, and this is Jesus is summoning out the disciples. Then Jesus summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to cure every disease and every sickness. These are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, also known as Peter, and his brother Andrew. James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. Philip and Bartholomew. Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector. James, son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus. Simon the Canaan, and Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed him. So you'll notice there that he's called the first, and he's the only one that's given a number, and he has two names. There aren't that many that have two names. So he's a significant person. Listed first, called first. Ten chapters later, Matthew 20, Jesus says, so the last will be first, and the first will be last. This is this inherent tension that I'm thinking about in the figure of Peter. And so he sort of embodies this tension of being the first, a disciple, someone who says the first will be last. So let's just stop for a second. What do you see in terms of our masculinity criteria? Probably not much for wealth here, although maybe a little bit with Matthew. But what do you see here in terms of control and divine service?
He at least has seniority over the others as he's the first one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the disciples are given authority over other people and demons, and Peter is given authority over them. So there is somewhat of a hierarchy here. We don't always think about it that way, but there seems to be a hierarchy.
A lot of dominating control over others with casting out spirits, curing diseases, every sickness.
Yeah. So there's control over other people's bodies. And, you know, we saw this a little bit yesterday. It's liberating control, or it's kind of for your own good control, but it's still control. Mm-hmm. My kids don't always like my for your own good control. And this is honestly anyone who's parented or been in that kind of relationship. This is the tension you have to strike with a child of that child has bodily autonomy. And yet, I cannot let you run in the street. Mm-hmm. And so I have to have this discussion with Axel all the time, and the girls too, but he's at that age. Yeah, I need to protect him, and I do things for his own good, but I am, in fact, controlling him. And he doesn't want that. He wants autonomy. Mm-hmm.
Do you think, the other day, you were showing the brothers of, so do you think the fact that he has a brother, does that have anything to do with, because that was significant in the Roman Empire that they had family members. So
yeah. They're always talked about together. In the call story, they're talked about together. And here, they're talked about together. But it doesn't say, the names of the 12 apostles are the brothers, Simon, Peter, and Andrew. It's Simon Peter and his brother, Andrew. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like the Gigi's favorite word right now is sidekick. She's like, I'm nobody's sidekick. You're right, you're not. So, I think there's still maybe a preference for Peter, but Andrew was attached. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, most of the names have qualifiers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. Simon's one of the few. Not only does he not have a qualifier, but he has a second name.
A second name, yeah.
So in order to know who Matthew is, you need to know it's the tax collector. You know, there's
there's the reference. And there will be little stories about them in the gospel. Like we'll learn more about Peter and his name and his authority in a couple of chapters. Yeah.
I don't know how it's punctuated in Greek, but I find it interesting that everybody is in pairs, whether they're obviously brothers or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's part of that's our use of semicolons in English. We like semicolons. But the brothers are definitely listed as pairs. Okay. So let's move on a little bit. So this is just the introduction, and I wanted to introduce that inherent idea of tension between what I would call sort of hegemonic masculinity in terms of leadership and then discipleship. That this is the tension that we're going to find within Peter's character, and then I think also in the church. Okay, so this is Matthew 14. Immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. He is Jesus. After he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone, but by this time the boat, battered by the waves, was far from the land, for the wind was against them. And early in the morning he came walking toward them on the lake. But when the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified, saying, "It is a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." Ego eimi, right? I am. Yeah. Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come out to you on the water." He said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat, started walking on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he noticed the strong wind, he became frightened and began to sink. He cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and caught him, saying to him, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" When they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." Oftentimes when we hear this story in church, we're thinking about faith, trust, doubt. We don't often think about masculinity. But what does that lens bring to this story? Think about control, not just over bodies, but over creation. Remember, I showed you the one where it said that Nero was the Kyrios, the Lord of the land and of the sea. So here, Jesus demonstrates that he is controlling land and sea. That's, that's something to talk about, right? That's Jesus showing divinity. But then Peter walks on the water. I think he's the only other human who does that, even just for a couple of steps. That's interesting.
And Peter challenges Jesus. There's a masculine thing there where he challenges him.
If it is you, yeah, to command me to come out onto the water. Yeah. I think if I remember, the conditional here is the indicative, which is the since it is you, command me to come. But I don't know that. I would have to check that. Yeah,
it's interesting though that even in the even in that challenge, he is asking to be commanded. Like,
yep.
He's giving up power to Jesus, saying like, "Prove it's you," but in a way that's like, "Make me do something."
Yeah,
have power over my body.
Yes. So there's vulnerability in the rhetoric of the challenge that Jesus has to prove who he is. But there's vulnerability that Peter's making himself vulnerable. But if it is you, then I'm going to put myself in this life and death sort of situation, and I'll be able to do something that I'd never be able to do otherwise. It's very interesting.
You don't think he's challenging Jesus? Like, I want to be show me that I can do what you do.
I think you can read it that way. Absolutely, I do. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time understanding why you'd want to. My other logic would sort of take over. Peter's a fisherman. He's done this his entire life. He's never been able to do this before.
So wouldn't he know how to swim?
Theory, right? You know, the other ones, he's naked when he's swimming, so maybe he's swimming with clothes on. Maybe he gets weighed down. I don't know. So I think for this story, there is the question of the control over bodies, but then also this divine service element, because Jesus brings up the faith issue at the end. You know, Peter shows this dramatic faith at the beginning. You can read it as a challenge, but it's also a trust, because he really does think if Jesus is capable of this, he'll be able to walk on water. And so he this divine service thing, he's got this idea of Jesus being divine, having divine elements in what he can do. So he shows this immense trust. And then the next thing that happens is he sinks. And it's Jesus is the one who uses the faith word when he says, you know, "You have little faith, why did you doubt?" So Peter has this push-pull thing with faith. And we think about that a lot in terms of faith and trust. We don't think about it in terms of masculinity as much. So Peter being able to align himself with Jesus, it's like, yeah, except I'm drowning. And I think that pattern with Peter shows itself a couple of more times. And we don't normally think of this in terms of masculinity, but it is this sort of juggling of at what status am I trying to reach, you know, relative to the disciples or relative to Jesus. So I like this as a metaphor and an image for what Peter's about, and also sort of the internal conflict that you see in his character.
Can we also look at 33? Because now it kind of expresses the dynamic of the group.
Mm-hmm.
In the fact that now everybody within the group is now recognizing that Jesus is now the leader. Versus when you look at it before with the calling, kind of reinforces the hierarchy of, okay, you have Jesus here, then Peter, everybody else follows.
And everybody else.
But then Peter's trying to exert it appears that Peter was trying to exert some sort of, trying to get some sort of power within this particular scene.
Yep.
And then...
And it didn't work.
And it didn't work.
Yeah. He can always say he was the only one to walk on water, but it was only two steps and then he falls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what does that do to the rest of the group in terms of their image of him?
Right.
Yeah. Yes, by the end of the story, Jesus is firmly established in the group as the hegemon. You know, he's the leader. Mm-hmm. He's the one who has control. And Peter attempts to have control, succeeds more than anybody else does. Nobody else even tries, but it's ultimately a failure.
Mm-hmm.
This is a pattern. This is a pattern for him.
Huh. Wow, that's really interesting.
All right, anything else you see? All right, let's go to the next one. This is the big one. So this is a couple chapters later. This is Matthew 16. This is the ceiling of St. Peter's.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see along the bottom that there's Latin written. And then that's the "you are Peter." What we're going to read here at the end of this text is in the dome above you. They take this really seriously in Rome. So seriously. All right, there's lots of keys and stuff. Okay. Now, when Jesus came to the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist." Hey, we just had him. "But others, Elijah," who also was supposed to be John the Baptist, right? "And still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." And he sternly ordered the disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. So, go.
Power and control and binding and loosing.
That's incredible amounts of power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so the keys to the kingdom, there's a reason why that's a symbol in all of the iconography and in the statuary. That's Peter shown with those keys. Mm-hmm.
And it's Jesus who gives it now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if you're the guy who can hand out that power, what does that say about you? Yeah. And remember, back here, you know, he had given them authority over unclean spirits, and it was given to all of them. And then now in this text, it's just Peter.
Mm-hmm.
That gets the specific responsibility.
I don't know if it's significant, but Jesus asked the question, "But who do you say that I am?" And it was Simon Peter who answered. And maybe mm-hmm. just like the walking on the water, it's Simon Peter who is like impetuous, who's just like going to be the first to act and put his foot out, like take the risk.
Yeah, and in a sense, there's like a flash of immediate insight. Like he gets it.
Mm-hmm.
He understands what's going on.
But he has courage as well.
Mm-hmm. Right at the outset.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, courage at the outset. Yeah. Austin.
Because I talk about naming a lot and I read about naming a lot, noticing that it's not only that Jesus is renaming Peter, Peter is also renaming Jesus in that moment because the messianic secret hasn't been let out yet. And so the changeover of power from one to the other seems to happen both ways in terms of naming.
And they both sort of get elevated in that process of, well, you're this and you're this, and everything gets ratcheted up a step. Mm-hmm.
There's also the divine service piece of it, because Jesus says that God has given this information to Peter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily even Peter that has this information, it was divine given.
Yes. Yeah, he says, "You didn't come up with this on your own." Right, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. So it's not an earthly knowledge, it's a divine revelation. And so there's that, that Peter has this line, that there's been this revelation to him, which in some senses is more power, but another, it's not him. So it's a kind of an ambivalent thing to say. Yeah, it's
in this. Kind of in response to Austin's thought, it's interesting, Peter has that power of naming, but the way that this is laid out, Jesus is setting it up to give him that power to name Jesus then. Because it's not saying, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" And then, "Who do you say the Son of Man is?" It's you, Jesus. It's saying, "Okay, now who am I?"
Mm-hmm.
And then setting Peter up to name him the Messiah.
So it's like, if you get how important I am, then I'll be able to tell you how important you are.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. We don't read this text this way very often, but I think it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, first, what's the opposite of emasculated? What would that?
Yeah, I don't know. We have a verb for that, except to say
okay.
Establishing masculine status. Or
so, Jesus really gives Peter a big testosterone.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep. He says that you're connected to the divine. He gives him power over other people.
And power over heaven and earth. And
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're going to get to a text in just a minute where we're going to talk a little bit about forgiveness. And that forgiveness in the Gospel of Matthew is couched in economic terms, financial terms. So even though we don't talk about wealth very often in these stories, there is this sense of forgiveness is currency. So there is a sense of power there that he has that's sort of like currency. You get to decide how much people get and how much they don't get. That's a lot. Yeah, he definitely, there's a lift for both of them in terms of masculine status in the story.
Yep. But we all know Peter is imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of the, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven?
Yeah.
Is that to imply that that Peter that is a human, affirm that he's a human, and bound in both places he will never be totally heavenly, or what do you make of that?
I think that has to do with when people confess their sins, if you forgive them, then God forgives them. And if you don't forgive them, God doesn't forgive them. It's a text that's read in connection with ordination services, and it always creeps me out.
Yeah.
Creeps me out in my own ordination service. I was like, it's all forgiven, right? Like, I'm not going to be responsible for that. But it's a heavy, you know, it's a heavy burden as part of the yoke of the stole, right, to carry around. And so I think that's what that it heightens the sense of what you do, God respects, God honors. Was it one of you in the back? Is that Alan?
Just the Catholic notion of Pope is right here.
It's embedded here.
It's, yeah.
Yep. This is it.
Everything but the rib tube, right?
This is it. And so you can see how an extrapolation of masculine authority, papal authority, can come out of this text because of the way that it's sort of simultaneously reinforcing the authority of Jesus and the authority of Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that, you can extrapolate that theology, the ecclesiology. Yeah.
I think also Dylan mentioned yesterday, reminded of the Beatitudes in verse 17 that might bring out some of the tension. Blessed are you, which is not always a mark of power.
Yeah.
Blessed are the poor, blessed are me.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't all maybe always an elevation of status.
Yeah. I mean, I think that has a lot to do with how we, as I talked about yesterday, about defining terms. What is the definition of being blessed?
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of a loose definition is being close to God.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the jolt comes with the Beatitudes when you say it's the poor who are close to God.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of like an ancient masculinity, it's the wealthy who are close to God.
Mm-hmm.
And so here you have Peter who's close to God in this moment because he's been able to have this divine revelation. But Jesus has definitely messed with the idea that blessing almost looks the same and walks the same and talks the same. So there's definitely some ambivalence still there. Who else? Someone else was had a hand. Yeah.
I was thinking along the similar lines of like Jesus giving Peter this power in thinking about it from the perspective of the Beatitudes and the powerful on earth will not have power later.
Yeah.
It's almost like a burden of like you're gonna like it's not fun for Jesus to have the power of being so strong because he's crucified and stabbed in the side, and it's an unpleasant end, and so this power ends up being a burden for him, and he's passing on this burden almost to Peter. So it's a very strange, like, yeah, that's a very strange to look at it in the context of the verse that you showed on the first slide. That
yep,
kind of
the first shall be last, and the last shall be first.
Which got me thinking about like Peter being first and. But Judas being last, that like he's the betrayer, seen as this outcast. But does Jesus really have this strong love for him then?
Yes. Welcome to my fifth chapter. Judas is scary.
Yeah. Well, in the same way, the metaphor to ordination also makes sense. Like, I always used to think the stole was like a status symbol, and then of my own ordination, I was like, oh,
it's so heavy.
Oh. So, yeah, it is a burden. It feels far more like a burden than I ever thought it was.
Yes, yes. So you read this one, and on its surface, and I think it's there, you have this increase in status for both parties, that there's sort of this kind of crystal clear moment, and yet there are edges around that say all is not, this isn't really like one emperor anointing another, that there's other stuff going on here. Because what comes next? Because at the end, this is the establishment of the messianic secret, like you said in Mark and in Matthew does too. So then, what happens next? Do you remember? From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord, this must never happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. Then Jesus told his disciples, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? Or what will they give in return for their life? So it's these little, it's on the micro and then the macro. We're seeing this juxtaposition unfold of the first will be last and the last will be first. Makes a big deal about the primacy of Peter. And then the very next thing that happens is Jesus starts to talk about what's actually going to happen. And Peter's like, wait. Like,
This is not what I signed up for.
I don't know what I signed up for. Apparently it was vague. Right? But this is not what I signed up for. And so in the previous verse, right, Leah, it's Jesus who says, the divine has revealed this to you. And what does he call him here? Satan.
Uh-huh, right.
Yeah. So it's like last, first, it's very confused. Mm-hmm. Is Peter, in fact, the authority? Is authority what we want? So it's like Jesus sets him up, but then in the very next verse, tackles the whole thing down. This is this bigger question that I've been talking about all of the series. Do you beat the empire by out-empiring the empire, or do you beat the empire by dying? Because that is the power the empire has, is the power over life and death. So it was the only way to feed it to die and then have death win. That's interesting. Because I think there's an inherent tension in the church all the time of how do we get our message out? How do we talk about this? How do we resist evil in the world? I don't know, a lot of people don't use the word evil. How do we resist things that we struggle with or that harm people, that cause suffering? Do we do it by being, you know, stronger and fighting and using the tools of the world, or is it always death and resurrection over and over again? And that's an inherent, I think, tension in the church that you see in the character of Peter. What else do you see here? And verse 24 is the stickler about the control over bodies.
Yeah.
Because what Jesus is essentially saying is you're going to have to give up control over your own body and your own life in order to do this right. Mm-hmm. So in order to have the divine service piece, you're going to have to give up the control piece. And that you're not just going to die, you're going to be crucified. And that's because he uses that, take up the cross and follow me. Mm-hmm. So Jesus has this already, that's his path. But he's also saying that anybody who follows him will have this path as well. So this is one of the reasons why I'm always wondering what in the world made ancient people interested in Christianity, in this Jesus thing. You know, it was in Pompeii this spring, and there's so much religious life in Pompeii. It's rich and thick and all kinds of expressions, ways to do things. They already had the cult of Isis, so they already had a resurrection cult. What would make them interested in this? Especially when you have the guy, your hero, who loses control over his body and dies. Mm-hmm. It just makes me wonder.
So if Jesus is being presented as kind of the Uber man, that he has that motif, that, you know, that he's being presented that way.
Yep.
Verse, the last second paragraph there, he's in some ways he has the power, and now he's going to redefine what it means or he's the masculine,
yep.
he's now going to redefine
yep.
masculinity in terms of its opposites.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like that kenosis word, that self-emptying word that Paul uses in Philippians. That's what I was into thinking about. He did not account equality with God as something to be exploited, grasped, however you want to translate that verb, but emptied himself. Canonic love, taking on the form of a slave. Mm-hmm. So the establishment of the hierarchy is all for the purpose of dismantling by that end. We're just trying stuff on here. But it sounds kind of like theology of the cross to me. Mm-hmm. And as a Lutheran, I kind of like that. I kind of like that idea. Mm-hmm.
The 22 to 23 there, it's this exchange of Peter trying to take away control of Jesus' yep. control over his own body, mm-hmm. saying, like, no, you can't go do that. You mm-hmm. can't sacrifice your body. And it seems like Jesus responds by taking away Peter's connection to the divine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're no longer, mm-hmm. like, you're not the rock right now.
Right.
You're Satan, and you're just getting in my way.
So if you look at this and back it up and just look at it as an ancient reader who doesn't have anything invested in who Jesus is, mm-hmm. what you're seeing here is you're seeing public debate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's Jesus who wins. Peter tries to grab authority. And in the previous one, right, Jesus asks the question, Peter responds, and because Jesus has the upper hand, that raises Peter's stature. But here, all of a sudden, Jesus teaches, Peter challenges him, and then that diminishes his stature. So if you're watching this from the outside, that public speech and public debate piece is very, very present here. Challenge and riposte.
Do you have any insight on the use of get behind me? Because I think about if that's Jesus' enemy, like, I'm never going to want to put my enemy
mm-hmm. behind you.
It seems like the worst place.
Mm-hmm.
But is there, like, from the Greek, is there a significance to that?
It's not clear. No, there are different interpretations of what this means. If there are other people in the room who have thoughts about this, you know, some people say it's like, remember your place. Mm-hmm. You're supposed mm-hmm. to be a follower. Mm-hmm. Like, get behind me. But then the Satan piece makes you think maybe it is sort of a just get out of the way sort of a thing. What else? Anybody else?
He uses the word stumbling block in the mm-hmm. same next phrase.
Mm-hmm.
So that you don't want that in front of you.
You right. want it behind you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about my idea here about the inherent tension of leadership yeah. in the church? Yeah. You buy it? I think it's interesting.
And the next phrase, for you setting your mind not on divine things, mm-hmm. but human things, and many times in church structure, it's run too much like a business and not as much as a spiritual haven, mm-hmm. sanctuary, inclusiveness, and the whole bit. It's just like, okay, what are the numbers? What are the numbers? Mm-hmm. What are the numbers? What do we need to do? How can we buy it? No.
Right. So there's never any money. That's right. The only thing you need to know about church.
Yeah.
There's never any money.
Could you also possibly look at 22 as the fact that Peter's beginning to question his confidence as being leader, and therefore it's like, no, you can't go, you cannot go, mm-hmm. I need you with me because I need...
Yep.
Yeah.
So therefore, again, although we are discussing the fact that Peter's trying to challenge, you know, his role as masculinity, but then again, you could also look at it and say, but hey, I don't know, I'm not sure if I can do this by yourself, and you can't go.
Yeah.
And he's still kind of somehow trying to hold on.
I think so, and I think that fits nicely with the pattern from the walking on the water.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if it's you, you can call me out on the water and I'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But then as soon as he looks around and realizes what he's actually doing, he doesn't trust himself at all.
Mm-hmm.
So here is an inherent tension in, of course, masculine status being performative. Because if it's something that you earn by doing things, is it really you, or is it just luck? Like, you've just beaten that guy, and that guy wasn't very good, or, you know, there's this sense of instability and inherent insecurity when you talk about hegemonic masculine status. So I do think there's a sense of insecurity there of, can I actually do this on my own, or do I need Jesus to be here with me? Because it seems like he's giving me a lot of stuff to do, and a lot of authority, and I might not actually want all of that. Mm-hmm. Or at least I'm okay as long as Jesus is here. Like yesterday I said, there's some security in being the vice. Mm-hmm. And having someone else be the chair or someone else be the senior.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I want to talk about this forgiveness section. We have 22 minutes. That's good. This picture is of the statue that's outside the Peter Church in Capernaum. I don't know if you're familiar with this site in Galilee. It looks like a spaceship. The church looks like a spaceship. And it's built over what archaeologists are pretty sure is a very, very, very ancient Christian site that commemorates Jesus healing Peter's mother-in-law. So it's probably Peter's house. If there's anything in the Holy Land that we can say, this is probably it. That site is probably it. Because it was taken from a residential home to maybe more of a corporate public space very early. So it was a site in which early Jesus followers met and came together to worship. So they built the church so that you can look down from the center altar and see into the first century room. And then outside, you look over the Sea of Galilee, and then there's this statue of Peter. And I like how this statue of Peter has no immunity, no tension whatsoever. It doesn't look like to me. He is holding that key to the kingdom, grasping it up here. There's the fish at the bottom, and this is a very tall statue. So if I could probably sit down there on the rocks on the bottom, and it would tower over. Mm-hmm. This is a very large statue. So he's here holding the keys, which we've established is for forgiveness. So I'm going to read this text, and then we'll go to the next slide, which has the parable that Jesus tells in response. Matthew 18, then Peter came and said to him, Lord, if another member of the church sins against me, how often should I forgive? As many as seven times? Jesus said to him, not seven times, but I tell you, 77 times. You remember, so Peter's been given this authority over sins to bind and to loose, but then he tells him basically, you're just supposed to forgive all the time. So does that diminish that authority or change that authority? What does it do to it? That's interesting. Then the very next thing that happens is Jesus tells this parable. For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. When he began the reckoning, one who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him, and as he could not pay, the Lord ordered him to be sold, together with his wife and children and all his possessions, and payment to be made. So the slave fell on his knees before him, saying, have patience with me, and I will pay you everything. And out of pity for him, the Lord of that slave released him and forgave him the debt. But that same slave, as he went out, came upon one of his fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii, and seizing him by the throat, he said, pay what you owe. Then his fellow slave fell down and pleaded with him, have patience with me, and I will pay you. But he refused. Then he went and threw him into prison until he should pay the debt. When his fellow slaves saw all that had happened, they were greatly distressed, and they went and reported to the Lord all that had taken place. Then his Lord summoned him and said to him, you wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you? And in anger, his Lord handed him over to be tortured until he should pay his entire debt. So my heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother or sister from your heart. Whoa. No? It's all right. You can share if you want to. You don't have to if you don't want to. I just hear voices in the guy kind of.
I think that's the way it should be. It's hard. It's
forgiveness is hard.
Yeah.
But it is.
It's a miracle.
It is the expectation.
Yeah. You mm-hmm. The miracle that you do it because then you're released.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the rhetoric in terms of wealth?
Yeah.
Or control? It's a long text. Sorry about that.
But you know, they're not slaves as we would think of slaves, because mm-hmm. they have resources, and they're
right.
able to borrow money, and they're able to pay off debt. So it's a different representation of slaves
yeah.
than what we would think of.
Yeah, that's always important to have before us. This is not based on race. It's not, and so there were ethnic minorities who were slaves, but it was not a universal thing, and it was also not the kind of, it was the kind of slavery that could be bought out someday. It could be manumitted by your master. Slaves had a variety of economic status, places in society. Yeah, so the idea that the slave could actually earn money to pay off the debt, that's a thing that you could do.
I wonder about that in verse 34, where he's tortured until he should pay his entire debt, which if you think about it as you're kept somewhere and tortured, how are you going to pay the debt?
Right.
I'm wondering about, is it possible to pay a debt with physical, allowing yourself to be physically hurt in some way? Does that allow you to pay some kind of debt? Is that?
I don't think that's the intent here.
Okay.
I think the intent here is to keep ratcheting up the ruthlessness of the way that people are treating each other. That first he's put in prison until he should pay, and then he's tortured until he should pay. So there's like an intensification of the way they're being treated. Yeah.
That would be similar to the indentured servant status that a lot of people came to America with.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah. And a lot of they, especially if they were captured in war and brought in from the provinces, then yeah, that would have been the way. And it was very common for slaves to be in debt. Because if you were a slave but you could run this little bread shop out on the edge of your master's property, then you were in fact making money, but you owed rent constantly. So there was never any getting ahead unless you had some sort of other means of income. And so sometimes slaves did this thing where they did favors for one another and then they would earn income that way. And so if you could establish status over someone else, sounds like hegemonic masculinity, then you could eventually buy your way out. Yeah.
Thinking of that tortured until he should pay his entire debt, with this all as the context of this being a kingdom of heaven, I wonder if there's some sense of like, you can interpret that as like he will be in hell forever.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is never, like once you have been given the keys to the kingdom, been released from all of your debts, and then you choose to not take advantage of that and go and turn and be wicked to others.
Then you're rejecting.
Yeah.
You're rejecting what's been offered.
It'll take an eternity to pay your entire debt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, like, your lens about wealth.
Uh-huh.
So, is being in debt actually like being emasculated then?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I think so.
So maybe that the first guy, the top guy here, he's powerful enough or he's masculine enough that he can afford this. But the next guy that he forgave, he's like, okay, I'm not as masculine as that guy. I can't afford to give up any of my power or masculinity.
Yep. Yes. And there's a long tradition of hegemonic males forgiving debts or throwing parties, bread and circuses, in order to seem very, that's called benefaction. They were patrons. In order to seem very kind. Of course, doesn't matter to them. It's like $15, you know, relatively speaking. But for people who are not of the elites, it's a much smaller margin, much tighter margin. So can they afford to be as forgiving as the people who are on top?
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that is part of this question that Peter is asking. Like, how much can I afford to be forgiving here? And Jesus' response is, you should forgive as many times, you know, and multiplying different interpretations of the 70 times 7. Yeah. But when you're in the middle, you don't see it that way, because you see, relatively, I have to hold on to what I have if I'm ever going to have more.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me odd that maybe in the previous two sections, it seems like Jesus is sort of turning this idea of masculinity on its head. But here he seems to be completely buying into it.
Yes.
Basically saying,
yes,
the Heavenly Father is like the ultimate masculine man.
What is that about?
He has complete. He's going to torture you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what do you? Okay, now I'm not so keen.
I spent about a month in this spot, and I was like, I don't know what to do. Yeah.
So buy an indulgence. Maybe that's where it came from a little bit. That's so hard. Here's an easy way.
Mm-hmm.
Easy.
Mm-hmm.
And how that
changed
the
whole
church.
Heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother or sister from your heart. So
you did that on a nice way. Like, well, I guess he really wants us to forgive each other. But
mm-hmm. Sometimes we read the Bible in order to see how it is, you know, that our lives will work together nicely and it's insight. And sometimes we read the Bible and we find ourselves, Judith Federle uses the word, the resisting reader.
Mm-hmm.
So if you find yourself being a little uncomfortable and being like, is this really like the hegemonic God that I'm interested in? That's a faithful position. It's called being a resisting reader. Okay? So you can just take that in your pocket, take it home with you. That's okay, because we can be uncomfortable with things in Scripture and say, I don't know about that. That doesn't resonate with me, considering the other things that are said about God in this gospel. And it makes us ask questions like, is forgiveness really this important? That Jesus is willing to do this? Is he, in a sense, I wonder sometimes if he's maybe trying to mess with Peter a little bit, because Peter's trying to nickel and dime this thing. Mm-hmm. And he said, look, if you want to play the game of who deserves and who doesn't and how much and how many times, you go ahead, but that's where it goes. If you're going to be over here in the empire of heaven, we just forgive. And I don't know, maybe that makes that resolves my inner conflict a little. I don't know if it's the right interpretation.
Uh-huh. Or maybe Jesus is a product of his time, which was steeped in this masculinity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so maybe the empire of heaven has a little bit more of empire in it than we are comfortable with.
Yeah.
There also seems to be a tension in that, I mean, here Jesus has just given his teaching, how many times should you forgive? Not 7 times, 77. This guy only gets one chance.
One. And he fails. Yeah. But it's usually the thing that the first one that I get, I always tell God, this seems hard. Could I have had an easier one to start with? You know? You know, but you're right. It's like he hasn't even gotten to 72. He's at one.
Right.
He's struggling.
Do you happen to remember the convert? Was it how many denarii were in a talent?
Oh, I don't know. Okay. I'm the wrong person to ask that question.
Yeah, because the Greek word for 10,000 is myriad.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's not necessarily a number. It's still, even in the Greek, yep. It had that same kind of, it's a really large, almost infinite.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Unpayable amount. Yeah. Really. Unpayable amount. And I like that it's almost a metaphorical number, because it doesn't, it's the same thing with us. It doesn't mean anything. It, depending on your financial status, the number means nothing. So I think this text is very complicated. I think it follows the pattern, but I think it introduces some elements of hegemonic masculinity into the gospel itself and equates them with God in a way that we can't let go of very easily. We're going to have to sort of work our way through all of this. And that this is part of the inherent tension in our tradition, that this stuff is in here. Yeah.
It seems like when you go back to the first time Peter got it right and he said, you are the Messiah,
mm-hmm.
he got it right, except his vision of Messiah was still empire, right? You are the king we've been waiting for. So he didn't really get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where that leads. This is still the empire.
Mm-hmm.
This is where you go if you stick with empire.
Yeah. And here again, I think this is all within all of us. Even though we don't live in Roman times, we still traffic in wealth as power. We still traffic in control over other people as power and controlling ourselves. And there's a lot of rhetoric about righteousness, about who gets to say what's right and wrong, moral and immoral. So it's within each of us. So it takes a good law gospel preacher at this point would say to you, you won't be able to do this on your own. This has to be a redemptive work of the Holy Spirit, mm-hmm. because we're also caught up in this mess. Okay, let's jump a little bit because we only have about 10 minutes left. Now we're to the end, where we're going to talk about Jesus' death. Matthew 26. So there's 28 chapters in Matthew, so we're towards the end here. This is when they're at table, and Jesus has, so they're at their Last Supper. Then Peter says to Jesus, though all become deserters because of you, I will never desert you. Jesus said to him, truly I tell you, this very night before the cock crows, you will deny me 3 times. And Peter said to him, even though I must die with you, I will not deny you. So, next verse. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to his disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. He took with him Peter and the 2 sons of Zebedee, who are not named, just Peter's name, and began to be grieved and agitated. Then he said to them, I am deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and stay awake with me. Going a little farther, he threw himself on the ground and prayed, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not what I want, but what you want. Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, so could you not stay awake with me 1 hour? Stay awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. So the first one, we have this public speech, right, where Peter asserts that he will be faithful, no matter what, even if I have to die. And then 10 minutes later, he's asleep. It's just like, if you call me and I'll walk out on the water, I'll be able to do this. And 5 minutes later, he's drowning.
Right.
Yeah, this inherent, like, he wants to do this, and there's a glimpse here, and he gets it, and he's strong, and he's courageous, and then immediately it all falls apart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's us.
Yeah.
He's us. He is us, and I, in a spiritual, theological sense, absolutely. But I want to remind you, he's also the leader of this group of disciples. He's the one who's called first, and he's the one who's given the most authority of the group. So what does this mean for all the rest of them? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is Matthew, I don't remember, is it in the Gospel of Matthew where Jesus tells a story about the guy that says, I'll do it, mm-hmm. and then he doesn't do it?
Yeah, there's that parable, and there's also the one about the vineyard workers, and yeah, so there's very much this, the people who come later sometimes are the better ones, and the people who are there at the beginning who say they'll go, they don't go.
So Peter's always mm-hmm. saying, I'll do it, and then he doesn't follow through.
Yep, there's the first and the last thing again, the reversals.
This is before the resurrection. And so before the resurrection, Peter couldn't stay awake. But after the resurrection, Peter is crucified upside down, right? I mean, right. So does the resurrection make a difference?
That's a wonderful question, a perfect question. So I think we've kind of got this one figured out. Let's jump here. So this is the denial, and then we'll get to the resurrection. So Peter is sitting outside the courtyard. This is after the garden, so Jesus is taken away and arrested. A servant girl came to him and said, you also were with Jesus the Galilean, but he denied it before all of them. I don't know what you're talking about. Then he goes out to the porch. Another servant girl, notice they're both girls, and she said to the bystanders, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth. And again, he denied it with an oath. Who else has oaths? I do not know the man. Herod has oaths. After a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, certainly you are also one of them, for your accent betrays you. Then he began to curse and swore an oath. I do not know the man. At that moment, the cock crowed. Then Peter remembered what Jesus had said. Before the cock crows, you will deny me three times. So whose public speech here wins the day? It's Jesus's, right? Peter says, I will not deny you, no matter what. And Jesus says, well, before the cock crows three times, you will. And so Jesus is the victor there again, right? And also we have here, who outs him? Servant girls. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not even listed as women. So there are, again, there's this, like, the women are the ones who can speak truth and emasculate, which is not the way that it's supposed to be. And Peter swears an oath. And the other person we've heard do oaths in this gospel is Herod Antipas. And that gets him in trouble, makes him vulnerable. So anytime Peter swears an oath, he makes himself vulnerable. He swore that he would not deny Jesus. And then out here, he swears an oath that he doesn't know Jesus. So this role of public speech as a way to sort of increase your masculinity, or in Peter's case, save your neck, it doesn't work. Because he's lying, like he's above his pay grade. He's not telling the truth. And so he ends up being the denier at that point. So you have this enthusiastic person from the beginning who knows who Jesus is, that by the end can't. He just can't do it. All right, so after all of this is Matthew 27, and that's Jesus' crucifixion and death. And then the question becomes, what happens in the resurrection? Well, here's what happens in Matthew. Sometimes we forget. These are all kind of... Peter's not there at all. Mary Magdalene shows up, and the other Mary, and they go to the tomb. So in verse 7, go quickly and tell his disciples he has been raised from the dead. Verse 8, so they left the tomb quickly with great fear and joy, with fear and great joy, and ran to tell the disciples. Jesus meets them. And then in verse 10, Jesus says, don't be afraid, go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me. So the only people who see Jesus in Jerusalem are Mary and the other Mary. And then we have to go to Galilee, back up into the Lake Country, to find him. Now the 11 went to Galilee. They listened to the women. Isn't that awesome? Yeah. So if there's 11, that means no Judas. So Peter is there. To the mountain, which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. So think of the difference between this and the way the disciples are listed on the front page, on the front slide. Nobody's singled out, and Peter's not given a name or a status. So after the resurrection, he's there, but there's not much of a hierarchy left. Mm-hmm. think that's interesting. But there's still authority. Jesus says to them, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. So go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them and teaching them. So again, they're given a commission at the end, the Great Commission, to baptize and to teach.
What, is he taking back the authority he gave to Peter earlier?
I don't know.
Is he saying, no, it's all given to me. Mm-hmm. It's all given to you.
Kind of feels like he's saying, like, almost like, yeah, this thing's going to happen. I don't really know if it's going to work out, so just in case. And he's like, all right, it worked. I'm back. Like,
yeah.
I have the control again. Mm-hmm. And I'll always be there until the end of the age. Mm-hmm.
For Peter is all of us. He's all pastoral types who are not the authority, the ultimate authority. Mm-hmm. They are fallible.
Mm-hmm. And struggling, in a sense, with authority, power, and how to use it, and how to give it away, and when it, you know, when to stand up and be the bold, and when it's not going to happen. I think in terms of masculinity and leadership, the inherent tension that you see here is not that masculinity itself is questioned existentially, hegemonic power, because God sort of stays intact the whole time. But the way that that power is used on earth with Jesus is it questions all of this. And it goes back to that, how do you defeat empire? Like, the only way for Jesus to defeat empire is to die and then to come back to life. So to say empire's rules don't, they're not the final word. Mm-hmm. So the last thing that's going to happen to you is that the empire crucifies you. Something else will happen afterwards. Mm-hmm. But then we are left with this tension in our own leadership, in the way that we understand what it means to be a good leader. Do we still equate, this is my husband's area, not mine, but when we talk about leadership studies, do we still equate good leadership tactics with essentially masculinity, mm-hmm. cultural masculinity? Mm-hmm. Or have we, can we expand that to understand leadership that's multifaceted and carries connotation of other gender expressions? Because what this all comes down to is, I can do a nice project, and I can go to my defense, and then I can be called doctor. But I didn't do it for that. The question for me is, so what, in terms of how we treat each other and how the church functions? What does all of this mean? Is there any payoff for how we as community understand ourselves and how we organize ourselves and how we treat each other? Otherwise, there's no point in doing any of this. So that's always the question. They say you should leave everybody with a question when you're done. And my question's always the same. So what? Mm-hmm. That this is a different way to read the text. And there's a lot here. You all are very smart. It's so fun to have this conversation with you. And I think that's the question to be asking yourself. If there is inherent tension in the Gospel of Matthew and masculinity and leadership, so then what does that mean for how we organize ourselves? How do we react to Scripture? And how do we understand leadership and authority? How do we understand gender as it relates to those things? These are questions I think we have to continue to ask ourselves. Mm-hmm.
This might not be a fair question, but in the other Gospels, do they have the same arc for Peter?
In Matthew, it's just more dramatic. You know, nobody else has this thing where essentially you're given the keys to the kingdom, and whatever you say goes. Nobody else has that. So the Peter character, I think, is more, there's more of this. But there's certainly the denial piece. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But in the, again, going back to when he knew Jesus was the Messiah and he's given the keys to the kingdom, and that whole passage about the last will be first, it's the women that were first. Mm-hmm. They weren't even named in that passage because they are solo, but they were the first.
They're the first to the that's right, they're the first to the tomb. Mm-hmm. Mary and
spread the word.
And they spread the word.
Yeah. And they were believed. Mm-hmm. You know, in some of the Gospels they're not, but in here they're believed.
The disciples believed. It's just a number.
Mm-hmm.
And now Peter's lost his name. It's just a number.
Just a number. Mm-hmm. You can see empire sort of the context here, and it's floating in and out. But you also see these cracks in the narrative, places that we can push through, and say there's room here still to work with the text. Exactly. So thank you very much. I really encourage you, this is fun to play with when you read the Bible. And it's I think it opens up a lot of the reason I study masculinity is because as long as we have a sort of a core default that then everybody else is adjectival, like I'm a woman pastor, right? Or my husband's not a man pastor. As long as that's the case, then I feel like we sort of have this side conversation going. But when we start to name what is considered to be default, whether that's whiteness, right, or whether that's heteronormativity, or whether that's, in this case, masculinity, until we start to do that, I don't think we're going to get very far. But when you start to peel back the layers here and you understand, this actually doesn't serve any real humans. This is a system that's created to privilege some people relatively over others, but it's not liberative, and it's not life-giving. Then I think we have a chance to take it apart a little bit and rearrange some things, and then we'll see what we can build in the next era. So thank you very much.